God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer, and this week I'm joined by Chapin Hemingway. And we're going to be discussing the new film in theaters, Men in Black 3, starring Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones, and Josh Brolin. And we're also going to have a tie-in discussion of the checkered history of the movie, its pre-production, into production, and everything like that. And then we're going to wrap everything up with our top five unnecessary sequels. Hopefully that won't give too much away about our feelings of the movie. But Chapin, I guess I'll start right with you. This movie to me, I felt like there were some redeeming qualities to the film, but I felt like it wasn't enough to redeem it into a positive review in my mind. So I guess I'll just ask you, before we get into any kind of negative feedback, what parts of this movie worked for you?
I really liked the concept of the time travel, although I think a lot more could have been done with it. It was an intriguing idea to me because I think there's a lot of that sort of comedy that could be played with the Men in Black series, the Men in Black, you know, sort of organization and you know, what it was like in 40 years ago or whatever. I kind of liked that aspect of it. And, I kind of felt that, and, you know, this might tie into our top five a little bit, that, you know, I wasn't sure where else they could go with the characters that we have right now. But, with the sort of the modern day characters. But, you know, instead it was a way of, you know, maybe making it a little bit more new and updated and doing something besides this sort of, back and forth between Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith that we've seen before.
Yeah. I was interested in that too. I did like kind of the idea of having it set in the 60s. Although I kind of equate that to the mad menification of so much of our movies and television nowadays. You know, I mean, that show has become such a huge mega pop culture, you know, entity that, you know, you see it spilling over into the real world and now into other projects like this movie. And, you know, the big network started putting out shows that were set in the 60s, like the Playboy Club, which just did awful and what got canceled really quick. And then Pan Am, you know, which is about the flight attendants, so I think, and then you're seeing it spill into like fashion. Like there's like all these throwback clothes to the 60s now because of Mad Men. Now I think we're starting to see a little bit of that with this Men in Black movie where, you know, well, let's set it in the 60s, you know? And I think this kind of goes into what I think becomes an issue with a lot of sequels where they're not showing anything new or interesting or fun. And so they're just like, well, how can we make it different than the sequel that people saw, you know, in Men in Black 2, and it's like, well, let's just set it in a different time period. You know, it's like with the, I kind of equate it to the Friday the 13th sequels. Like, when they got to number 8, they were just like, well, let's set it in Manhattan. So it became Jason Takes Manhattan. And then they get to number 10, they're like, well, let's do it in space. And so it's Jason X, and he's on a fucking spaceship. You know what I mean? So that to me, while I enjoyed kind of seeing that time period of the Men in Black, you know, organization, it did kind of still have that feel of a, well, how can we set this apart from, you know, Men in Black 2, you know what I mean? So it still felt, even though it was kind of cool, it still felt kind of shticky because it was like they were just running out of ideas of, you know, how to make it interesting and different. But, I mean, that being said, I will say the big draw for me was Josh Brolin playing a young Tommy Lee Jones, Agent K. And I thought he actually did a really good job of just kind of becoming Tommy Lee Jones' character, Agent K, in a younger version, you know?
Yeah.
So I'll give him credit for that. That was a big draw for me, and one of the things that I felt worked really well. Other than that, I mean, I'm kind of – The other thing I think is that this sequel did have a lot of heart, and I give it credit for that. I feel like you really see how important their relationship is as partners. And I feel like it certainly had a lot more heart than Men in Black 2, although I don't think that's, you know, saying a lot. And so I also give it credit for that. So those are a couple of the positives, at least from my point of view.
But ultimately, you can't recommend the movie?
I would say no. I really can. I mean, it's okay. It's just sort of there, you know. I mean, I didn't hate it. I didn't really terribly dislike it, but I also didn't very enjoy it either. So it's just it's just kind of there. I think it just gets lumped in with so many other big budget summer blockbuster movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think. This will tie in a little bit to our discussion later on, but I think I don't know about you, but the first Men in Black was, I thought, really well done, and it was very, very funny and well made. But, you know, my problem with this movie is, you know, as we said before, you know, this wasn't a movie that a lot of people were crying out for. The sequel didn't do particularly well. It wasn't very well received, and we sort of ask ourselves why someone would make this movie. And I think Men in Black, unlike a lot of other, maybe some other series that could be sort of molded to fit certain needs of the public, for lack of a better phrase, this movie, you know, is sort of rooted in its tone. It would be difficult to get away from that and still be a Men in Black movie. So I think they did the best they could for a movie that nobody really wanted. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear you.
I mean, there's talented people. I think Barry Sonnenfeld is a great director, and Tommy Lee Jones and Josh Brolin, and especially Josh Brolin, I agree with you, and Will Smith all did a great job, and they've got good writers and stuff. But it's really the best you could expect from these people, and for a movie that really nobody wanted to see. I don't know really what else to say. I really thought that one thing that was particularly sort of disappointing about this movie is that it lacked a sort of the sort of tongue-in-cheekness that really made the first one work for me. I mean, I saw the second one, but I don't even really remember it. I don't even remember what happened in it.
I mean, I had seen it too when it came out, and I didn't really remember anything until I caught like part of it on TV a couple months ago, and then it was like Johnny Knoxville, and he had like a backpack, and in the backpack was his long neck that had his other head in it, and so he played this really stupid like two-headed alien, and I was just like, I can't even watch this, so I couldn't even like get going into it, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, the sequel, yeah, I mean, it didn't do really well, and it's surprising kind of to me that they decided to go ahead with a Men in Black 3, especially 10 years after the sequel had come out, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know, and this is probably one of the things we'll get into in another discussion, is the long road of Men in Black 3 coming out and all the different issues they went through with the production, and what made it so expensive. But yeah, it's sort of surprising to me to have them push for a third one now after how poorly the sequel did, and having it be so much longer, so much later after it originally came out. I do want to say one other positive, though. I really like the fact that they cast Jermaine Clement as Boris, the main bad guy.
Yeah.
And for a guy who is primarily known as being really silly and off the wall with Flight of the Conchords, I thought he actually embraced that role of like a beefed up, jacked up, like bad guy, like Boris, really well. Quite honestly,
yeah. He's been in some other movies that have, I think, would make, if you saw them, might have made him a little bit more of a understandable choice for that part.
Okay,
he's been in some other movie roles. I know what you mean. Like he plays kind of a square character in.
Yeah, I mean, I know he was in like Dinner for Schmucks, and he's in Eagle versus Shark, but never anything where he played kind of like this this real bad guy, you know what I mean? And he kind of plays like this very evil character. So it was just, it was a little surprising to me, especially because, I mean, I'm sure they kind of beefed him up with padding and stuff, but I mean, if he probably had to get into some pretty good shape to play that character too.
Yeah, he had a lot of makeup on, I think.
Yeah, a lot of makeup, and I'm sure they padded him out to make him look more muscular than he really was, because he's a really skinny guy. But I think he actually embraced that role really well and did a good job as Boris.
I did
so that's
too.
That's three positives I can say for this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this kind of, you know, like your other suggestion for this week was seeing Battleship, and I mean, it was sort of the two movies. It was just sort of the lesser of two evils in terms of what movie to see. And again, it's just been kind of a lot of bad movies coming out. A lot of unnecessary sort of point. I think, you know, conceptually is where these movies really have a lot of problems. I mean, why do people want to see a movie based on a silly board game? It seems kind of laughable, and I think that's generally how the public felt, because not a lot of people saw that movie.
Yeah, that tanked. Yeah, I mean, well, and my reasoning for seeing that was simply, you know, if we were gonna watch like a big budget, over the top summer blockbuster, I'd rather see one that was at least new to me in Battleship than Men in Black 3, which I felt would just be like a rehashing of the same stuff we'd seen before, which, you know, ultimately I think it kind of was, unfortunately, despite setting it in a different time period. And so I think coming out of both movies, we'd probably have the same thought process of, you know, it is a big bombastic blockbuster that's just there. You know, I don't think we would have we might have hated Battleship. I don't know, but
I think we probably would have.
Yeah, I mean, but just to me with Men in Black, it's like I just feel like I'm indifferent. And you know, I think maybe because I've liked the original so much back in 97 that's the reason I feel at least indifferent to it. Like, I think if this was a new property that I hadn't seen before or had no idea, I might have actually disliked it even more. I think maybe the reason I'm just indifferent to it is the fact that, you know, I have that relationship with the original film and like the original film a lot. And that's kind of keeping me from saying, oh, this movie was just atrocious. You know what I mean?
That's an interesting point. That's a good point. I wonder if that's true. You know, I was going to ask you sort of tie in with that. Do you think that if you saw Men in Black now, like the first one with your knowledge of movies and your understanding of what movies can be, et cetera, that you would think it was as good a movie as we maybe remember it to be? I mean, I don't know. I'm not even sure how big a fan you were of the first one. I mean, I definitely liked it, and I think it was well made. But do you know what I mean? Like, do you think that our assessment of this movie, you know, if we were to watch them simultaneously, sort of right next to each other in, you know, 1997, would we think these movies were about the same?
You know, I bet because we would have been. I mean, let's see, when Men in Black, the original, came out in 97, I wasn't even quite 12 years old yet.
Right.
So I was 12 that year. So I think maybe because I was younger, I liked that film more than probably I would if I watched it now at my age and having gone through film school and everything. So I think if we sat down when we were both younger, like in 97, and we watched these same two films, I'd say I would have liked probably the first one a little bit better, but I would have thought they were both pretty good in my almost 12-year-old mind. But now, I don't know if I would like Men in Black, the original, as much had I watched it now, just straight out, not having seen it when I was younger.
Right.
And I think, you know, and quite honestly, I think we see that with a lot of movies where we get really attached to movies we watched when we were younger because, you know, they just are part of our childhood and we really enjoyed them. And so, you know, and I kind of, it's like when you know somebody now who's older, your age, who hadn't seen, I don't know, The Goonies or like some other really classic movie of your childhood, and you're like, oh, you have to see it. And they watch it and they're just like, eh. I mean, it's kind of, I think, is what it would be if we watched like Men in Black, the original, now, not having seen it when we were younger, you know?
Right.
They don't have that same connection to it because they didn't see it at that time when they were younger.
I think that makes sense. I was just sort of trying to get an idea of whether movies are actually worse now than they were. And
I think we're just more jaded. We're older and jaded.
That's probably true. That's probably true. But switching gears to the production of Men in Black 3, it seems like they went way out of their way to make this movie, and they spent a lot of money. I don't know. Did you have a chance to look over that at all, that article?
Yeah. I mean, I had a chance to take a look at it here, and I mean, it is just sort of crazy that they could get so far into a production like this and then have to like stop and just like redo like so much of the story.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's just crazy that a studio is spending that much money. And I think maybe this really goes to something that really, I think, annoys a lot of us and a lot of film people about the decisions that studios make, is they're pumping hundreds of millions of dollars into this movie because it's a sequel, and yet they don't even have a completed story yet to it.
Right.
And I think if that's just not like, if that's not an indication of like how little studios can sometimes care about story, then, you know, I don't know what is. Because, I mean, you know, if it's a smaller, more independent movie, kind of what it really has going for it is probably the story. And I would say, you know, as people who went to film school and who went through that whole process, you know, it's kind of beaten into your head that, like, you know, story is what matters. And so to see a big studio like that just spend hundreds of millions of dollars of already and then have a giant 3-month break that costs another millions and millions of dollars on it while they're trying to still figure out what the story is going to be is kind of, it's really almost depressing, honestly.
Well, we should say that the article in the LA Times suggests that they filmed the modern day sequences, and then they were sort of reworking the end or something like that. And they stopped for 3 months in production, and it was just extremely costly. And I agree with you, Brantley. I think that I don't know if it necessarily speaks to a lack of consideration for the storylines, but I just think that it seems that this movie was really motivated by Will Smith's desire to make another one, which I think is like sort of the wrong way to go about it. And we always look at these. I think we've spoken to this before, where movies, you know, they sort of they're developed from the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we, like you said, we've been taught about stories and traditionally, you know, you would think the genesis of an idea comes in somebody's head, they write it on a screenplay, it's sold, people make a movie out of it. But so often, especially in the case of sequels, that just really isn't the case. It's more a studio executive saying, this is a good idea, figure out a way to make a third one. And then in order to get the gears going and the wheels in motion, things are sacrificed. And a lot of times that's coming up with a good story, which you would think would be the easiest thing. You give a screenwriter who in the scheme of above the line talent is on the cheaper end, a couple million dollars to get a script going, and then you make it. There's so many people out there with great ideas and who can come up with interesting angles, but it seemed that this movie was motivated by Will Smith having an open schedule. I mean, he hasn't made a movie for 4 years, which I found interesting, and he was like the biggest box office star in the country. And you know, Tommy Lee Jones being available, etc. So to me, that I'm very often critical of where these movies begin and the motivation for their conception, which is so often, you know, a monetary or financial point of view. And you know, I don't know how a movie like Men in Black 3 would be made under the circumstances I would like.
Yeah.
You know, but I think, you know, the series that we have come to cherish the most are the ones that are at least helmed by a auteur who, you know, comes, who writes them and comes up with their own, you know, schedule for how they like to make them. I don't think that clearly the Men in Black series has been jaded in that sense, because they made the second one, you know, 5 years later, and then this one another 10 years after that. And, you know, it seems like they, you know, it doesn't come from a creative place, which I think is problematic.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you know, I think we in an ideal world, we'd like for studios to make films based on come from a creative place, like you say. And I try to I try to understand that they are a business and that they need to make money, but I think too many times with studios, they go overboard. And I think we're seeing that right now with, say, G.I. Joe 2 Retaliation. I have no idea if it's going to be good or anything, but, you know, I'm sure you heard the news where they decided to push that back to next year because they want to post-convert it to 3D when it was never shot in 3D because they want the higher ticket prices so it can make more money. I mean, it's just such an obvious gambit of, like, trying to make more money out of these summer blockbuster movies that it's just, you know, it's just kind of depressing to see how much of it is just solely business driven as opposed to creative. And I think they have gone just far too much onto the business side of it. I don't think you see very many studios try to make smaller budget independent movies. I think they're just content to go to festivals and pick those movies up. But it's getting increasingly more difficult for independent films to get funding for them unless you're making a micro-budget film and you can do it through Kickstarter, you know? Because if you want to make a small $2 or $3 million movie, which quite honestly is not very much in even in the budget of independent film world, I mean, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to get that kind of funding, even for a small film like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, studios don't pick up movies anymore. That's a thing of the past as well. No, nobody's buying movies anymore.
You don't think so?
No.
I'm reading all this stuff about all the movies getting picked up at con.
Yeah, but it's so much smaller than it was before.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. I mean,
and con is now they're a lot of those movies have been already
produced. They're already produced. Yeah. No, and that's the problem with a lot of the big festivals too, is that they're just showcases for movies that studios already own rather than a place for independent films to get a chance to be seen and get picked up. And I think that's a disappointment. But I mean, you're certainly right that not nearly as many films are getting bought at festivals as they used to be. You're absolutely right. And they're not spending as much money on them either. But I think it still is, I still think festivals are a place where people, if they get in with their film that hasn't been picked up, do at least have a chance of finding a home with some distributor of in some way, shape or form. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of off to on a different tangent, but I mean, it is just disheartening to see how far studios have gone to the business side as opposed to the creative side. Yeah. And I mean, I think we've been seeing that shift. Well, we've been seeing that shift forever since like the 80s, but I think lately we've been seeing it just in terms of all the films that are being made that are not coming from original scripts anymore. We're seeing tons of sequels. We're seeing tons of comic book films. We're seeing tons of films that were based on, you know, a book or something. I mean, I think very few times are you seeing like a big movie that gets a wide release that's truly an original creation, and that truly, you know, is coming from a place of creativity as opposed to a place of business.
Right.
Anyway. That's my little tangent. And the most disheartening thing I think about this article that you sent me from the LA Times is that at the bottom, there's the line, if the film succeeds, it could pave the way for a Men in Black 4.
Right.
And I'm just like, ugh. Well, apparently it took in $200 million worldwide, which...
it's hard to beat that, yeah.
It's hard to beat that. I mean, granted, I mean, you know, compared to the Avengers, which took in over $200 million just domestically, you think, wow, but... I mean, if you spent $375 million with marketing and all that other stuff, you do $200 million in your first weekend worldwide, you're probably going to recoup your money in the next few weeks, you know?
Who are we? We are no one.
Our mission is to monitor extraterrestrial activity on Earth.
Flacco! You know you're not supposed to be north of Canal Street.
Who is Flacco?
Just relax, punk. They're looking for me, not you.
Crazy, right? Two grown men talking to the wall talking back. It's a mess. But hey, don't even worry about it.
All right, so for our top five, we're doing our top five. What is it? Our top five
sequels?
That's what I like.
Sequels no one wanted?
Yeah, top five sequels nobody asked for.
Yeah.
So Brantley, I'm going to go over to you for criteria and your number five.
All right. Well, my criteria, I tried to go with like direct sequels, like the second movie in the series. And I tried not to do movies like Friday the 13th, which have like 10 sequels, or, you know, like big like series of like horror movies, like the Nightmare on Elm Street series or the Paranormal Activity or Saw movies or all those. Mostly because like with Saw and Paranormal Activity, I haven't even seen them, so I don't care. But so I'm going specifically just with the second movie in the series. Although I think one of mine does have more sequels after that. They were all horrible. But anyway, my number five is Caddyshack 2.
Oh,
the first one was great. There was no reason to make another one. I don't even know if they got like the regular cast together for that. I think it was just a bunch of like almost nobody. I think maybe Chevy Chase was in it for a little bit, but I don't think they got like anybody else. Like Tom Arnold, I think, is in the sequel and stuff. It's not nearly as good, and no one wanted it.
Yeah.
So that's my number five.
Okay. Well, you already mentioned my number five. It's G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Okay.
I think I actually did see the first G.I. Joe maybe on HBO or something, and it was pretty awful, and I don't think it even really did that well financially. So
it did not seem to, no.
I'm not sure why they made another one, but they did, and it's completely rebranded, and there's like a whole different group of people in it.
Mm-hmm. I think Channing Tatum's back again.
Yeah.
But otherwise.
Well, yeah, Channing Tatum. So that's my number five. I don't think anybody asked for that, and I don't think it's going to do well, which maybe explains why they wanted to go back and squeeze every last dollar out of it.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, quite honestly, the second G.I. Joe is more appealing to me than the first one was.
Really?
The first one just looked awful, just looked atrocious. But the second one, I mean, it still looks bad, but it still looks at least a little bit more interesting than the first one did. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, my number four is a sequel. I don't even know why they made it. I think it went straight to DVD. There was no point to it in my mind because it has nothing to do with the original, really, except that the character in it is still a psychopath, like in the first one. And that is American Psycho 2. Which stars Mila Kunis, if you do not know, as the psychopath. And I don't know why they made it. It was awful. And the first one is really good. The first one's one of my favorite movies. Probably like a top 25, one of my favorite movies of all time. I think it's a really kind of a masterpiece. And that's why. That's why I hate that movie.
Have you read the book?
I have. The book to me is a little way over the top and gets really nasty. And I think the movie is a better representation, quite honestly.
Really? I love the book. I mean, it's one of my favorite books. But I think it's just, the movie is even more brilliant if you figure out that's the source material.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's parts in the book about some of the torture he does, which is just awful. I mean, much worse than what's in the movie, quite honestly.
Yeah.
And I think you know which one I'm referring to.
I mean, there's plenty to go around.
Yeah, but so that's why I think the movie is better in my mind. Well, and I think Mary Harron, the director, just like knocks it out of the park in terms of
great job.
In terms of just getting the tone of the book without necessarily all of the horrible things that are in the book. But it's funny because, you know, when you watch it, it's not any more awful than any horror movie you see. And I don't know if you saw This Film Is Not Yet Rated, the documentary about the MPAA. Mm-hmm. But in it, you know, she talks about how they gave her an NC-17 because they just were objectionable to the entire tone of the movie.
Right.
And it's like, well, how do you change the tone of a movie? You know, it is what it is.
Right.
So, I really like that movie. I'm glad to hear you're a big fan of it too.
I am. Yeah. I mean, it's a great, and I, you know, I think the book is misunderstood, and
yeah, I think the book really got cast as like this misogynist book that like promoted violence against women,
right?
Which I think is just ridiculous if you actually read it. But it is tough to read. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. It was brutal
Yeah.
to read. Anyway.
All right, so my number, am I my number four?
You're on your number four, yeah.
Okay. My number four is the sequel to the third Indiana Jones movie. It's Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
That almost made my list, but because I was going with the second movies, it did not. But no, that's a good one. Yeah, that was bad.
Yep. And I mean, again, like, why do it? Why make it? I mean, it was so much longer away, and I mean, you know, like, sometimes if it takes if a movie just takes, that was another movie that was sort of in development hell. How do we get this done? How do we make it?
Yeah.
And after a while, you sort of have to say, well, maybe it's not worth it. Maybe there's a reason why it's taking a lot of people a long time to get it together.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, no, that's a good choice. My number three. Is a movie where the first film isn't great, but it's just a fun, stupid action movie. And it's Speed 2,
which is on a boat.
Which, you know, if you disliked the first Speed, like, if you didn't even think it was, like, fun or entertaining in any way, but you had to sit through Speed 2, then Speed 2 makes the first Speed look like friggin' Gone with the Wind in comparison. It was so awful.
Yep. That's a great one.
That's my number three.
That's a great one. All right. My number three is Die Hard 4.
Ah, good pick.
There's a lot of, like, sequels with big lags between the previous film. Again, that John McClane just doesn't belong in the era of Bourne and Daniel Craig Bond. So
he's a rusty old man. Not the iteration that they came up with that, because he just became like this over the top action hero instead of what made the first Die Hard so great, which he's just like this regular cop, you know, like this regular guy, you know? Yeah. And, the fourth one is just like, it's so over the top in terms of like what he's doing. And I also dislike the fact that they took New Hampshire's motto and then did nothing about like this movie being tied in New Hampshire in any way, shape or form. You know, that would have been enjoyable to me. Like, if Timothy Oliphant's character is like headquartered in like Manchester, New Hampshire or something, and he's got to go up there from New York or something, that would have been like at least reasonable. But instead they just took the motto of the state for no reason, really, just because they could. They're just like, yeah, let's do that.
I know.
Why not?
I don't think a lot of people know that that's – I think most people don't even think that states have mottos, much less.
I don't know.
I mean, that one's a particularly cool one. But besides that, I mean, I don't know what our state motto is.
Quite honestly, like, New Hampshire has by far the coolest state motto, that's for sure. But, I mean, I think a lot of them are just Latin, you know, just something like that. But anyway, so my number two is a sequel to an 80s movie that I find to be awesome. I think it's funny. It's a blast. Obviously, I watched it when I was a kid, so it kind of has that place in my heart like we were talking about before. And it's Teen Wolf 2. Which they replaced Michael J. Fox with Jason Bateman, I believe. Was it Jason Bateman or was it the other guy who looks just like Jason Bateman that I always confuse him with? No, it was Jason Bateman. Yeah, they replaced him with Jason Bateman, and it was just – there's no point in it, really.
Yeah.
They're just trying to cash in on the Teen Wolf craze. But Jason Bateman came out of that still a great actor, still a very funny guy, and still had a good career. So that's pretty awesome.
All right. Are we on number two?
We're on two, yeah.
All right. My number two is Jaws 2.
Oh, that's a good pick. Very good pick.
I don't know why they – I mean, I guess it seems kind of inevitable that they wouldn't make a sequel to the biggest movie ever made at the time, but I wasn't a fan, and it sort of ruined the – there was no need to make it.
No, that is an excellent pick. In fact, it's such an excellent pick, it is my number one.
Ah.
Well, I mean, really, I could have gone with any of the Jaws sequels, but – because they're all just awful. But Jaws 2 just kind of started them all, so we'll just stick with that one. You're right. It's inevitable since it was the biggest movie of all time at that point, but there really was no point in it, really, in any way, shape, or form. And they were just awful, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them all. I don't know how I sat through them all, but they were all very bad.
Yep.
Anyway, what is your number one, sir?
My number one is Red Dragon, a movie, a sequel to a horrible movie. No, a prequel horrible movie. Yep. A prequel to a horrible movie and a...
Wait, you're saying Silence of the Lambs is horrible?
No, but it's a prequel to... It was a follow-up to Hannibal.
No, it's a prequel to the original Silence of the Lambs.
I'm aware of that, but it...
Oh, okay.
The movie it followed was Hannibal.
Yes. I'm trying
to think in terms of chronologically through the movie.
I see what you're saying. I see.
And it was also a remake of a movie that had already been made by Michael Mann, nonetheless.
Manhunter. Right. Yeah, it's called Manhunter, which is awesome.
Not necessary, in my opinion.
I see what you're saying. See, that's funny, because I actually just rewatched Hannibal and Red Dragon a little while ago. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, I didn't think Red Dragon was that bad.
You know, it's not that bad. I suppose it fits into the category for me because it just wasn't something anybody wanted to see. It had been made before. But, you know, yeah, it wasn't that bad. So,
I mean, I think the reason they made it is just because almost no one knows about Manhunter. You know, if you ask someone, hey, who played Hannibal Lecter first, they're going to say Anthony Hopkins. He's like, no, it was Brian Cox, actually, right, in Manhunter. Like, I think no one really – I think that's why they did it. I mean, granted, it was obviously just to make money because they were capitalizing on the other two properties of the Silence of the Lambs kind of trilogy. Mm-hmm. But I watched it again because I read the book, because I'd read all of them kind of in a row after I'd seen the movies. And so I decided to rewatch Red Dragon and see if that lives up to the book. And I mean, both Manhunter and Red Dragon are pretty faithful. Although I would say that Red Dragon probably is a little bit more faithful than Michael Mann's Manhunter.
Yeah, but that doesn't make
although
it a better
Manhunter's
movie.
A better movie though. Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's a good call.
All right. You want to take us out?
I will. All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up on this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We encourage everyone to check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. We have all of our reviews, articles, videos, podcasts. They're all up on there. And we encourage you to go check them out. If you like the podcast, go listen to some more. And we're also on iTunes if you just want to get subscribed and have them downloaded and all that stuff. But we want to thank everybody for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.